Sports Illustrated. My name is Bill, volunteer reader here at Sun Sounds of Arizona. Let's begin today's reading with a feature from this month's Sports Illustrated. And this feature is a one-on-one interview with Anike Ogwumike. And this is conducted by Sports Illustrated writer Emma Bachelieri. While attending the 2023 NCAA Women's Final Four, amid an electric atmosphere that would soon tip into national conversation, Anike Ogwumike thought, now this is different. That weekend in Dallas saw Caitlin Clark and Iowa pitted against Angel Reese and LSU. And it set up the WNBA for explosive growth a year later. The league changed on almost every level in 2024. Just ask Ogwumike. With the Storm, the 13-year veteran forward was named an All-Star for the ninth time in her career, while moonlighting as the president of the WNBA Players Association, a job that she has held since the year 2016. And in all that time, she never imagined playing in a league that looked as it did last season. Ogwumike has steered her fellow players through a variety of challenges, but never one as exhilarating as this. The highly anticipated 2024 draft class brought the record viewership and attendance, and the WNBA's surge in popularity resulted in some major wins for its players, such as the introduction of charter flights. Rookie of the Year Caitlin Clark attracted unprecedented media hype and converted it into ratings and merchandise sales. But all of that growth came with growing pains, Ogwumike notes, with the intense spotlight bringing new security concerns and ugly discourse. In October, the union decided to opt out of its collective bargaining agreement with the WNBA, choosing instead to renegotiate in the wake of the league's new 11-year media rights deal that is worth $2.2 billion. With the current CBA now set to expire at the end of the 2025 season, Ogwumike and the rest of the WNBPA have their sights set on higher salaries, better long-term benefits, improved facilities, and making sure that this boom isn't just a moment, but a chance for lasting progress. Sports Illustrated asked Anike Ogwumike, what did the growth of last season feel like for someone who has been here as long as you have? And Ogwumike responds, I have more of an attitude of like, welcome y'all, hey, what's up? The water's warm. There are a lot of different emotions. I know, especially for the players, every experience with this growth was not positive. And I like to attribute that to being the growing pains of something that's really taking off. But I lean heavily on things that are to be celebrated and to be discovered, to be curious about, and to be built off of. So a lot of my emotions were around not just the excitement of bringing in new faces, but also the pride in engaging with those who have been with us for so long, and then ultimately everyone coming in and recognizing that we all have a hand in this growth. Sports Illustrated's next question to Anike Ogwumike: you mentioned the growing pains of this year. What are some of the biggest challenges? And Anike responds, I think that the biggest challenge for me, truly the pains of growing, were a lot of new followers and different cohorts that came into something that we have cherished for so long, something that we've respected and admired for so long, and understanding that increased popularity is not all pretty. I really hate hearing stories about players having to deal with, hecklers would be putting it lightly. There's a lot of harassment that players have had to deal with. It doesn't matter who you're a fan of. It was experienced across the board, but most certainly by a lot of these black women who ultimately are the foundation of this league. And so I don't hope, I expect, because that's the only thing we can do, I expect for things to not just get better, but also for there to be more respect, for there to be more education and perhaps more curiosity and less hate. Sports Illustrated's next question: as the conversations around the league got bigger, as those new stories got more involved, was there anything that you felt was being missed? And Anika responds, I think that there are always stories that can be told. There is something that I've noticed and have been more vocal about since I joined. I think ensuring that there's a diversity in storytelling and just heralding players who are doing awesome, I think it's important for us to not miss those things as players. We try to do our best to be on the right side of things, or at least acknowledge when something's happening, and I see that the league is growing in that way. But I do feel as though there's always a point of emphasis there when it comes to just facing things head on and with integrity and transparency in a way that I think that the players really do appreciate. Sports Illustrated's next question: did you feel like the league was prepared to navigate that change? And Anike Ogwumike responds, I don't think anybody was. I think we all had been anticipating growth, and for it to happen in the way that it did in this past year, I'm not sure that anybody was ready. And so, of course, we're making sure that we can get things done and stay true to who we are, while also addressing and preparing and being ready for whatever comes our way. It's really no knock. I think that these are great problems to be talking about, but I also think that it yields more learning opportunities. Sports Illustrated's next question: and what did the process feel like for you? Anike says, I don't like to panic when things start to change. I like to observe and see how things are going. But I feel like the pivot kind of occurred the year before that. Being at that Final Four and see what that environment was like and slowly experiencing that at the professional level, it wasn't necessarily a jolt, but I did feel as though once you started playing games live, you're realizing like, man, it's loud in here. I can't hear anything. And getting the charter flights and being able to sleep in your own bed. The night after playing in Atlanta, I'm sleeping in my bed in Seattle. That's something I definitely had to get used to. I think I went from feeling overly prepared for any scenario to now being able to relax a little bit and focus on playing. With so many of these changes and being able to engage with fans and share in the celebration and the love of the sport, also came resources like the practice facility that I get to play in and how we get to travel. It's not just the experience, it's the vitality of what we do. We're able to perform at a level that maintains this excitement that we're seeing come in. Sports Illustrated's next question, how did that change the conversations that you've had as a union leader this year? And Anike says, you know, there's been more hanging in the balance relative to the time that we're playing in. And so conversations with different athletes have been mostly about being smart, knowing that we have options, ensuring that we capitalize on the options that we do know that we have now, and maintaining our collective collaboration and the vision towards what we want. And my conversations have changed because the composition of the league is very different now. I'm serving my third term, and I was very young in the beginning, still almost looking up to those players that I was representing. Now, at age 34, I'm older than almost all the players and have had such an experience playing and also being a part of the executive committee and the players' union. I feel as though I can maybe impart a little bit more advice and a little bit more guidance and kind of view it as passing the torch. I'm not playing forever, that's the reality. And I wanted to be able to leave things better off than when I entered it. Sports Illustrated's next question, how do you feel that you've grown as a leader in those 8+ years? And Anike replies, I definitely lean into a kind of servant leadership. It's who I am. I'm a Cancer sign. I'm an oldest daughter in a Nigerian family. There's no escaping how I help and I nurture, but I think that I've tried to also lean on that for myself, helping and nurturing myself, whether it's educating myself a little bit more or understanding that there's really no boundaries on who you can learn from. I learn a lot from different athletes in this league, different women in this league. They don't have to be older than me. They don't have to be more experienced. There's a lot to say when I'm able to have conversations that yield information or experiences that I don't personally have. I think that's kind of the beauty of why we're able to mobilize the way that we do in the W. Sports Illustrated's next question, you mentioned the idea of more hanging in the balance here, of having a lot of options and needing to capitalize. How are you thinking about leverage and power heading into these negotiations? And Anike replies, I feel like it's time to stand on business. You find yourself in different positions, not randomly, not by chance. I think that the time is now, and we are here. And to not take advantage of that, it would be a disservice to ourselves, to the league, to the union, to the history, and to the future of women's basketball. Sports Illustrated's next question, how do you set priorities for a negotiation as big as this one? And Anike replies, it's definitely not me who does it. There's a team for a reason. We have a phenomenal staff with the Players Association, and we have an amazing board of advisors. And so a lot of what we do is teamwork. That's where the communication comes in. That's where asking questions of players and asking for ideas and pitching anything they feel can make this league and their experience and the experience of those to come even better, and also those who have played. What the players say is what is priority. And Sports Illustrated's next question, is there anything that stands out as particularly important here, or anything that you really want to make sure that you all can address at the table? Anike replies, we're still kind of in the early stages. It's no secret that salary and compensation is something that's very important, especially as we continue to see expansion of teams and also as we continue to see so many people aspiring to play in this league. This is touted as the best league in the world, and so making sure that people are paid in a way that reflects their value has always been a priority, and that has not changed. Sports Illustrated's next question, so much is in flux right now. You have a huge cohort of players coming up in free agency next year. You have teams building new practice facilities. You had a slew of coaching and front office changes this year. How do you think about what the future looks like, both as a player and as a leader who is trying to chart a course? And Anike replies, I'm a very optimistic person. I'm very idealistic, I guess you could say, and so I feel like the future is blindingly bright, honestly. I mean, I'm 13 years in this league, and I've now played in what I could say is a home at our practice facility, and I've flown charter. I never imagined that would happen, let alone while I was playing, you know? And so these indications to me show that we've always been feeling from the inside is it's finally coming to fruition. I envision us being able to play only in the WNBA and not having to supplement incomes. I envision athletes from other countries aspiring to come and play and have careers in the WNBA, perhaps only in the WNBA. There is so much that can, and I think will, happen. And I really feel like we're just on the cusp of it. Sports Illustrated's next question, what does it feel like to see those possibilities open up, or at least have the timeline speed up in a way that might have seemed unthinkable 5 years ago when the last CBA was signed? And the reply, it feels amazing, you know? It feels surreal, but it's not. I'm also trying to make sure that I occupy this space of, yeah, this was supposed to happen, and not one out of fear that it will disappear. I'm someone who always wants sustainable change, and I hope that those who are also contributing to this change understand that we want this to last a long time. And Sports Illustrated's next question, and how do you think about ambition in that context? You want this to be sustainable, you want to make sure that this is going to last, but you can also dream much bigger than you could a few years ago. And Anike replies, I think that when you're in an industry like sport, and specifically women's sports, I'm not sure if enough should be in our vocabulary. I think that you always shoot for the stars. You can never shoot too high. And I say that with the confidence that we exist as a cohort of women who understand the business to the degree that we can negotiate and aspire and strive for things that make sense. Things that make sense today, that make sense for us, and that makes sense to build off of in the future and right now. Nothing is enough right now. Sports Illustrated's next question, what else do you want people to know about the league right now? And Anike replies, I am overwhelmed with how much we are experiencing. I am hoping that fans and followers are also excited, and they understand that this isn't just a moment. This is what we have been talking about for such a long time, and I want us to continue to respect and build and honor those who are here, those who were here before, and those who are coming. And we need to establish that, yes, we have the foundation of being built from a very long-standing and existing professional league. And again, that was an interview, a one-on-one interview with basketball star Enike Ogwumike by Sports Illustrated writer Emma Bachelieri. And another one-on-one interview was made by Sports Illustrated with boxing champion Canelo Alvarez. With an eye for drama and ear for a good track, the super middleweight boxing champion has shown that Mexican music and boxing are a match made in box office heaven. And this interview was conducted by Sports Illustrated writer Gilberto Manzano. Canelo Alvarez did not want to tell one of Mexico's hottest musicians how to produce a hit song, but he felt compelled to offer a few suggestions for building a lively crowd before a fight in Las Vegas. Input was encouraging, and there was no overstepping because this song was specifically made for one of Alvarez's ring walks, which tend to get just as much attention as his fights. Alvarez, boxing's undisputed super middleweight champion, knew the original version wasn't quite right. The song needed to build anticipation and adrenaline. Luis R. Conriquez sent over a different take with violins, and Alvarez loved it. He imagined the violins playing in a dark arena filled with nearly 18,000 spectators, the bows and strings taking their time to entice fans to scream, "Canelo, Canelo," before the focus turned to the four-division champion and the artist of the special ring walk song. Once the tweaks were made, the lyrics to what was entitled Martes 13, that is, Tuesday the 13th, did the rest. The song, which ended up being streamed on Spotify more than 72 million times by the end of the year 2024, starts by saying where Alvarez is proudly from, Guadalajara, Mexico, before reminding his opponents that fight night is bound to be an unlucky one. In Mexico and other Spanish-speaking countries, Tuesday the 13th is similar to Friday the 13th in the United States. The song, which debuted last May before Alvarez's unanimous decision over Jaime Munguia, goes on to say good luck is for the mediocre. The kind of preparation that Alvarez put into the song shows why he remains the box office king of boxing. In this sport, the spectacle and the build-up are just as important as the skills needed to become a world champion. People have to care in order to sell fights, and the 34-year-old has kept their attention as he approaches the back end of his career. Alvarez has drawn interest by prioritizing Mexican representation on the biggest stage. It's not just the classic mariachi songs from Vicente Fernandez blasting from arena speakers. Alvarez's collaborations with up-and-coming musicians have brought younger generations to the dying sport. He's had walkout performances with Fuerza Regida, Santa Fe Clan, and many other emerging artists. Some have even benefited from the exposure that comes with singing the Mexican national anthem before an Alvarez mega bout. With the help of Alvarez's worldwide platform, many Mexican artists have crossed over into the U.S. mainstream. Fuerza Regida, Peso Pluma, and Conriquez have landed songs on Billboard's Hot 100 list. No longer are these Spanish-speaking artists solely staying in their categories of Latin or regional Mexican music. Alvarez has done what so many businesses in the U.S. have failed to do, appeal to the Latino audience, Mexican Americans who speak English first, but use Spanish with their parents and older relatives. Alvarez's brand and popularity increased after several interviews of him primarily speaking English went viral the past few years. His command of the language is far from perfect, but many appreciate the effort, not to mention the fact that he doesn't care what people think about his accent. Alvarez is worth millions and doesn't need to keep fighting, but he has found a way to be relatable in his late prime years. Sports Illustrated interviewed Canelo, and we begin this interview with saying 2024 was a good year for you, Canelo, defeating and retaining your titles against Jaime Munguia and Edgar Berlanga. But it was also a good year for Mexican music. Peso Pluma, Fuerza Regida, Conriquez, Chino Pacas, Junior H, and the list goes on. For you to see Mexican music explode in the U.S. and worldwide, how big was that for you? And Canelo Alvarez replies, "It was huge for me, for all of Mexico, because the Mexican artists are competing with the biggest and best artists in the world. They're also very young, the Mexican musicians. I'm proud of all of them. I'm very proud of those who have accompanied me to the ring for my fights. Also, I'm very proud to be Mexican and to represent Mexico." Next question from Sports Illustrated. Do you make it a priority to give more attention to newer artists? And Canelo replies, "Yes, I try to walk into the ring with those that I like, the music that I'm listening to, the right song that I want to walk up to. And for this occasion, Conriquez made me a special song, so we came out on that one. But these are mostly songs that I have listened to, and the artists add their twists to highlight me and the upcoming fight. But yes, I do decide who will be walking out with me for each fight. Honestly, it's a priority for me to have these special walkouts because you feel proud and energized to be able to walk with these grand artists. People feel proud and excited to see the representation. I cannot stress enough how big this is." Sports Illustrated's next question, "Did you have an idea of how big Luis's song Martes 13 was going to be?" And Canelo replies, "I knew that was going to be a very special song. I knew that was going to be a giant hit. I was involved in the process of making it. Luis sent me the first verse, and I said, 'No, that's not right. What I want when I'm heading towards the ring is to feel the emotions, be pumped up, to turn on the adrenaline. I want all of that turned on when I'm walking towards the ring. At the same time, if I'm hyped, then the entire crowd is also going to get hyped. The people are going to feel the energy, and it's going to be a hit song.' The words were excellent. There were a few minor changes here and there that were corrected. The words got even better. But when he sent me the other version, I told him, 'I really like the violins.' He already had a song with violins, and I told him, I really like that because I imagine the entire arena, all the lights off, and the violins begin to play, and then the focus is on us. I'm for Guadalajara. I loved that. I knew that song was going to be very popular, but I didn't imagine that it was going to get his first gold record for Luis R. with that song for Martes 13. I was very happy about that. Next question from Sports Illustrated. Did Luis give you a credit for being a producer of the song? And Canela replies, oh no, that's all for Luis and those he works with. I got involved a little bit because it was used for my ring walk. It wasn't my song. I just needed to feel motivated when the time came to head to the ring. That was it, but all the credit was for them. Luis has the ear and the vision for what makes a hit song. When he sent the version that I liked, it didn't require much from me. That song was already made. I knew that was the right one and on a different level. Sports Illustrated's next question. Martes 13 became a heavily used song on social media as part of a trend where users recreated your ring walks. What did you think about that? And Canelo replies, it was impressive. I don't really get that much time to see what's trending on social media during fight week and a few days after the fight. But then I got caught up. After seeing all the videos that people made, I just wanted to interact, and then I followed the trend and made one of my brothers, Ricardo Alvarez, and his co-workers at his taco shop. I just wanted to join in on the fun, and I am very grateful that people enjoy what I share on fight night. This was for them to enjoy a grand event. Next question from Sports Illustrated. Do you want the next Mexican boxing star to follow your lead by representing your country in various ways during fight night? And Carnelo replies, I would love that. Records are meant to be broken. I would love for a Mexican boxer to do that and follow in those footsteps and to continue raising the bar from what we have already accomplished. Next question from Sports Illustrated. You've already had numerous title bouts. Do you still fight because you want Mexico to continue getting this kind of exposure? And Canelo replies, yes, of course. But it is also because I love what I do. I still enjoy boxing. Obviously, everything has its limits, but right now I feel great, and I feel like I'm in my prime. I still enjoy this sport, because when you talk about money, I don't need to keep fighting anymore. But I want to keep growing in everything, including my heritage, and expanding historically while continuing to do what I love the most, which is boxing. So with all that, I'm going to continue moving forward. Hopefully the day that I hang up the gloves, there's someone else coming up, hopefully Mexican, to continue representing all of Mexico. And again, that one-on-one interview with Canelo Alvarez was conducted by Sports Illustrated writer Gilberto Manzano. And from boxing news, let's turn now to some baseball news. The next feature has a headline that reads, 30 questions for opening day. What can make or break each Major League Baseball team? As most of the league kicks off the season this week, here's a look at some of the biggest concerns and hopes for each ball club. And this feature written by Tom Verducci of Sports Illustrated. The stateside version of opening day is on Thursday. It's the most hopeful time of year. The sky is blue, the canvas is blank, and even the Chicago White Sox haven't lost a game yet. But the reality is opening day is full of questions, too. Here are 30 questions for 30 teams, beginning with the Los Angeles Dodgers. Question: will anybody throw 150 innings? Last year, Gavin Stone led the staff with 140.1 innings until he blew out. The Dodgers have mastered the new pitching paradigm. Throw and spin the tar out of the baseball, but do it with less exposure. That means Shohei Ohtani might not see a mound until June. Roki Sasaki will throw no more than 120 innings. Tyler Glasnow might barely exceed his career high of 134 innings. Yoshinobu Yamamoto, a 5'10" right-hander who hit 98 his first time out this season, should not exceed his 108.2 innings of last year by more than 30. And Blake Snell, who is 32 years old and has thrown just 2 qualified seasons, will get lots of abbreviated starts and extra rest. Here's what the Dodgers know. If they get any 3 of that Fab 5 to October healthy and with gas in the tank, nobody is beating them. From the Los Angeles Dodgers, now let's look at the Philadelphia Phillies. Question for the Phillies: is this the end of their window? JT Realmuto, Kyle Schwarber, and Ranger Suarez are eligible for free agency after this season. The offense has 5 players in their age 32 or older season. Realmuto, who's age 34, Nick Castellanos, age 33, Bryce Harper's age 32, Trey Turner's age 31, and Schwarber, age 32. None of the past 24 playoff teams have had more than 3 qualified hitters 32 and older. Since 1947, only 2 teams made the playoffs with 5 regulars that old: the 1982 Angels and the 2007 Yankees. Next, we look at the New York Yankees. Question for the Yankees: does Aaron Judge have enough support without Juan Soto? Job number 1 for the Yankees is to get Judge pitches to hit. On pitches in the strike zone last year, Judge hit 361 and slugged a ridiculous 793. He saw a higher percentage of pitches in the zone than in any season of his career. Why? Juan Soto was on base all the time. The Yankees don't have a certified leadoff hitter, and they need both former MVPs Cody Bellinger and Paul Goldschmidt to rediscover their power behind Judge to get the big guy pitches to hit. Then there's the Milwaukee Brewers. A question for the Brewers: is Jackson Chirijo a 30-30 MVP candidate? The outfielder looked a bit lost through the first week of June, hitting 209, including 141 against non-cutter fastballs. And after that, how about an MVP-type slash line of 306 batting average, 525 slugging percentage, and a 322 average against heaters? The kid is a fast learner with an ease in big moments beyond his 21 years. Then we look at the San Diego Padres. Question for the Padres: do they keep Dylan Cease all season? The right-hander, who turns age 30 in December, is headed towards free agency, and a Corbin Burns-like contract with a $210 million neighborhood. San Diego should be in the playoff hunt, but it may have to see what Cease can bring them at the trade deadline even with tremendous fan support and working on a fourth straight winning season for only the second time in franchise history. Then let's look at the Cleveland Guardians. Question for the Cleveland Guardians, do they have enough starting pitching? It's a question that we're not used to asking, given their success rate with pitching development. Last year, they reached the players with a rotation that ranked 24th in Major League Baseball. This year, Gavin Williams is a huge key because he has the highest ceiling. Luis Ortiz, swiped from Pittsburgh in a trade, has quality stuff but needs to learn how to get it in the strike zone more. Then there's the Baltimore Orioles. Question for the Orioles, is Adley Rutschman back? The Baltimore catcher had one of the worst and sudden declines you will see from a great player. After 2 years with MVP votes and a 64-game start to last season that looked in line with his elite level, Rutschman fell off a cliff over his last 87 games, where he hit .206 with a .301 slugging percentage. His exit velocity in that time cratered from 89.5 to 87.1. Then there are the Atlanta Braves. Question for the Braves, are Spencer Strider and Ronald Acuna Jr. as good as new? Both stars are coming back from major injuries. You can talk free agency and trades all you want, but no team is adding a possible Cy Young Award winner and MVP the way that the Braves are. Atlanta was a league average offensive team last year, down from the number one offense the previous season. And from Atlanta, next let's look at the Arizona Diamondbacks. Question for the Diamondbacks, does the bullpen bounce back? The highest scoring team in Major League Baseball missed the playoffs by a game last year, losing game 156 to Milwaukee after an 8-0 lead, including a 9-6 lead with two outs in the eighth inning with the bases empty, was the dagger. An inconsistent bullpen was one of the reasons. The Arizona bullpen ranked 25th in strikeout rate, 26th in ERA, and 27th in WHIP. The D-backs don't have a named closer. That's never a preference, and plan to spread the job among Justin Martinez, Kevin Ginkle, A.J. Puk, and Joe Mantiply. Then there's the New York Mets. Question for the New York Mets, do the Mets add a Game 1 starter? Kodai Senga has Game 1 stuff, but has a history of injuries. New York has rotational depth, but not the kind that matches the rotations of the Dodgers, Braves, and Phillies when it comes to elite swing-and-miss stuff. The big prize is Sandy Alcantara, if the Marlins make him available. And next, let's look at the Houston Astros. Question for the Houston Astros, how does Jose Altuve take to left field? Metrics and their unreliability aside, Altuve's defense at second base must have been awful for the club to move a franchise player off of his career-long position. He does not have a plus throwing arm. There is a learning curve to any position, and at age 34, he will do more running. Still a premier offensive player, Altuve remains a vital part of Houston's success. Then there are the Kansas City Royals. Question for the Royals, can the rotation do it again? Kansas City used an older school rotation philosophy to forge its turnaround season. The Royals mostly kept their starters on the fifth day. They let them throw more pitches per start than any team but the Yankees. Only the Mariners and the Phillies had more quality starts. Then there are the Detroit Tigers. Question for the Tigers, is this the best pitching staff in baseball? Last year, only the Mariners and the Braves posted a better team ERA than Detroit. Now mix in Alex Cobb, once he's healthy, and welcome back Jack Flaherty, and give the ball 20 to 25 times to Jackson Jobe, one of the most talented young pitchers in baseball, and the Tigers might be even better at run prevention. And from Detroit, let's go to Seattle and the Seattle Mariners. Question for the Mariners, is it time to make T-Mobile Park more hitter-friendly? Here are the Mariners' home slugging ranks over the past seven seasons starting in 2018. 24, 24, 30, 30, 22, 24, 29. It's not just the ballpark. Seattle has run through a ton of hitting coaches and philosophies while it wastes pennant quality pitching. And from Seattle, now let's look at St. Louis and the St. Louis Cardinals. Question for the Cardinals, which young players are part of the next winning Cardinals team? It's one thing to give playing time to young players. It's another to figure out who can live up to the expectations. Mason Wynn looks like a fixture, but Dylan Carlson didn't make it, and the jury remains out on Nolan Gorman, Michael Cieni, Victor Scott II, Jordan Walker, Alec Burleson, and Matthew Liberatore, all aged between 23 and 26. Then there are the Chicago Cubs. Question for the Chicago Cubs this year, how much offense will they get from Pete Crow Armstrong and Matt Shaw? Crow Armstrong posted an OPS plus of 88 in his rookie season, though his second half was more like the player who showed pop in the minors. The 5-9 Shaw showed good contact rates in the minors, but after an injury limited him to six spring training games, he will see a gauntlet of great pitching in his first month in Major League Baseball. The Dodgers, Diamondbacks, Athletics, Padres, Rangers, Phillies, and Pirates in the first 32 games. Next, let's look at the Minnesota Twins. Question for the Twins, how many combined games for Carlos Correa, Byron Buxton, and Royce Lewis? Last year, the trio made it into only 270 games, just 55% of the total available. All three are impact players, but Minnesota has not been able to count on their availability. Next, we look at the Boston Red Sox. Question for the Red Sox, which prospects will make an impact? Outfielder Roman Anthony, infielder and outfielder Christian Campbell, and infielder Marcelo Meyer are all knocking on the door. Each of them is likely to get some run during the season, if only because of injuries. Anthony and Campbell are most likely to force the Red Sox to give them more playing time. Then there are the Tampa Bay Rays. Question about the Tampa Bay Rays? What effect will they experience with home games at an outdoor minor league ballpark? The Rays have terrific behind-the-scenes facilities at George M. Steinbrenner Field, but their home schedule is front-loaded to avoid playing too much in the summer heat and rain, which makes the middle of the season a slog. In one stretch, they play 35 of 47 games on the road. Their pitchers will miss the climate-controlled Trop. Then let's look at the San Francisco Giants. Question about the Giants: what do they get from Justin Verlander and Robbie Ray? The two former Cy Young Award winners can make this rotation formidable if they stay healthy. Verlander, now age 42, is coming off of a 5.48 ERA in 17 starts. Ray, who's now age 33, is coming off of a 4.70 ERA in 7 starts. Both pitchers have flashed the stuff to think that the ceiling is still high. But how many starts can the Giants count on from them? Then we look at Texas, the Texas Rangers. Question for the Rangers: who has more volatility in their rotation? Nobody. Workhorse John Gray already is out with a broken wrist. Cody Bradford has a sore elbow. Tommy John returnees Jacob DeGrom and Tyler Mahler haven't pitched a full season in years. Jack Leiter and Kumar Rocker are rookies with outstanding stuff that will need to be handled carefully. Nathan Eovaldi, age 35, with 2 Tommy John surgeries, is their anchor. From the Texas Rangers, now let's look at the Cincinnati Reds. Question for the Reds: what is the ceiling for Ellie De La Cruz? He led the league in stolen bases last year while hitting 25 homers and posting a 119 OPS plus. Great. He also struck out a league high 218 times. Not great. He struggles against spin with a 190 average, and from the right side of the plate, he hits only 224. But he's only 23 years old with good walk and chase rates, which means that if he cuts down on his strikeout rate just a little, he's looking at a monster season. And from the Reds, let's look at the Pittsburgh Pirates. Question for the Pirates: how many innings does Paul Skeens throw? Last year, the Pirates kept Paul Skeens on strict limits for the first 2 months. When he arrived in the big leagues, they never pitched him on the 5th day, electing always to give him that extra day, extra in quotes here, because for years now, most Major League Baseball starts are made on the 6th day. This year, President of Baseball Operations Ben Sherrington is not ruling out Paul Skeens getting the ball on the 5th day sometimes. After Skeens threw 160 innings last year, including the minor leagues, he should be good for up to 185 this year, something that only 13 pitchers did last year. From the Pirates, let's now look at the Toronto Blue Jays. Question for the Blue Jays: does Vladimir Guerrero Jr. finish the year with the Jays? Both sides are still interested in a deal that would make Guerrero a lifetime Blue Jay. But every day he gets closer to free agency, the closer he will be to discovering his true market value. As part of due diligence, Toronto at the trade deadline will have to explore what his value is on the trade market. But the Jays are not likely to be blown away. Look at what the Orioles got for Manny Machado in 2018. Rylan Bannon, Yusnil Diaz, Dean Kramer, Zach Pop, and Breivik Valera. Total WAR for the Orioles from those five is 4.0. From the Blue Jays, let's look at the Washington Nationals. Question about the Nationals. How good are James Wood and Dylan Cruz? Wood, age 22, impressively posted a 354 OBP and a 122 OPS plus in 79 games last year. And when he learns to pull the ball, he had one home run in the pull side. Look out. Cruz has plenty of speed and gap power with home run power to come. Then there are the Athletics, formerly called the Oakland Athletics. Question for the Athletics, does Lawrence Butler take another step forward? Why not? He's a former sixth-round pick who struck out 32% of the time in the minor leagues in 2021, but he keeps getting better. Butler broke out in a big way in the second half last year, hitting .300 with a slugging percentage of .553. It convinced the Athletics to lock him up to a 7-year, $65 million deal. And that's all the time that we have for this reading of Sports Illustrated. My name is Bill, volunteer reader here at Sun Sounds of Arizona. Thanks for tuning in to this week's edition of Sports Illustrated. If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org/broadcast info. And you could hear Sun Sounds on your smart home device.